Hello, and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars, artists, and librarians about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm pleased and honored to be talking today with Michael Corris. Michael is an artist, critic, and an art historian in the Division of Art at the Meadows School of Art at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. And he'll be talking with us today about his most recent book, Leaving Skull City, Selected Writings on Art, published by Les Presses du Réal in 2016. Michael is one of the founding editors of the Fox magazine, the New York venue for the conceptualist art collective Art and Language, and has written extensively on modern and contemporary art in publications that include the Art Language Journal, Art in America, Art Monthly, Art Forum, Art Journal, Art History, Art Text, and the list goes on. He has also published in a number of monographs, including his own edited collection, Conceptual Art, Theory, Myth, and Practice, published by Cambridge in 2004. And he also edits the Reaction Press series entitled Art Since the 80s. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So part of what you have to say in the essays in this book that were written over time has to do with your own place in the story of the Anglo-American conceptual art movement in the 1970s and the fact that you were both a member artist of these collectives and also you're a critic and historian, you know, so multiple hats in a way. So can you talk about your own history a bit, how you became involved in art and language, for instance, in Britain and then subsequently in New York?
Well, the work that I've done writing about conceptual art, I've done as a participant observer. Mm-hmm. But one of the interesting things about conceptual art, at least the kind that I was involved with and the people I was attracted to, was their sense that there really wasn't a boundary between the various kinds of professional expertise that you might identify as an art critic, mm-hmm. an art historian, or even an art theorist, mm-hmm. and certainly not an artist. There was a really strong urge to develop this idea of what I call versatility, but also for the artists to adopt many of the roles that had been parceled out mm-hmm. in the art world for a couple of reasons. First, I think to regain a kind of a sense of autonomy, an actual independence of interpretation and distribution of work. And to that end, you have now the very normal convention of artists as curators, but back in the 1970s, that was much rarer to encounter. You did have artists who would come together in groups of like-minded individuals and mount shows and promote their work. And of course, like Art and Language, and throughout the history of art in the 19th century, the 18th century, 20th century, you've got artists involved in independent publications who sort of promote their work. So that's kind of where I sit in terms of what I do and how I've developed that. In terms of how I got involved with Art and Language, it was really something I was interested in as someone who had visited exhibitions of conceptual art in New York, mm-hmm. but then working as a studio assistant for the French conceptual artist Bernard Vinet in New York, mm-hmm. one day, I was trying to mount some of his large photostats on plywood. He was mounting photostats on 4 by 8 foot pieces of plywood, and these were part of his work. He was getting ready for a retrospective that was going to take place at what was then the New York Cultural Center. So I was doing this job, and I was really doing it badly. I was ruining photostats, and Bernard is a really sweet guy, but he sort of just turned to me and said, Michael, what kind of artist are you anyway? And I just said, well, I'm a conceptual artist, Bernard. And he said, oh, that's fantastic. Do you know Mel Ramsden and Ian Byrne and mm-hmm. Joseph Asuth? I said, well, I know their work, but I've never met them. And he immediately gives me their contact details, and the rest, as they say, is history. And of course, once I started working with Ian, who was Australian living in New York, and Mel, who was British, but had also spent time in Australia as a young man, I then got to know the people in the UK and visited the UK soon afterwards. Uh-huh. And of course, as soon as I met them, they invited me to submit an article to Art Language Journal, because that was the way one became a participant in the group.
Yeah.
Through that sort of collaboration.
The medium was language, wasn't it?
I would say that we wrote texts that reflected on art, on the system of art, on the idea of what could count as art, and the texts were kind of ambiguous. Mm-hmm. They were considered to be critical texts as well as works of art, but we never quite agreed with the idea that we were using inscribed language as a medium in the same way that a painter uses paint or a sculptor uses some other kind of 3D material.
Yeah.
And this ambiguity has always puzzled people about our kind of conceptual art.
Yeah.
But I think it was really important to maintain that kind of indeterminacy about exactly what role language did play in what we were doing. In terms of Art Language Journal, that was the main output of the group for many years, from 1967, when the group was founded, up until about 1972. That was the principal means of which the work of the group was disseminated. And of course, the work was textual, so naturally, when placed against works by people like Robert Barry or Lawrence Weiner or Joseph Kosuth, you might imagine that we were in the same ballpark.
Yeah.
But in fact, we really weren't.
Some of those artists, like Weiner, denied being conceptualists. I mean, the people often think of as conceptual artists, but they say, no, they're not. They understand, you know, you were doing something different. So.
Yeah, and I think for them, for Larry, for example, there was a moment when he realized that he didn't actually have to enact the performance that he was indicating in the script.
Yeah.
So a very early work of his, throwing a standard dye marker into the sea, or creating a 1 meter square depression in the wall, or creating some sort of excavation on a driveway. These are things that he actually did, and this was his work as a sculptor. But then he realized soon after that he just had to indicate the action, and it didn't necessarily have to be performed. So he had a different relationship to language. For him, it was a kind of a script, and then, of course, it functions now both as a script, but also really as a kind of a slogan.
Yeah.
And his most recent work adorns buildings and so on and so forth, so it has a very different resonance, I think.
Yeah, and I was thinking also Dan Graham and Hans Hacke always sort of denied being part of your group also, although people also think of them as conceptualists. So.
Well, they certainly weren't part of Art and Language.
I don't like to be called conceptualists either. So
I know, because I think they, first of all, for Hans Hacke, I mean, he starts his work involved with systems, and this involves materiality and technical equipment, and then he extends that to social systems, and then it becomes quite elaborate. For example, works during the 80s, these enormous mise-en-scenes with elaborate props and installation environments. As far as Dan Graham's concerned, I mean, he is also very much a performative artist, and his work really, except for the early work, which I think that was kind of interesting, the way he was inserting his text, his poem schemas in magazines,
mass market
magazines, or the famous piece that he did on the architecture of the suburbs that was put, I think it was, I don't know if it was Art Forum or Art International, but in any case, he sort of went from actually starting off as a kind of a concrete poet, pretty much not in the same way as Carl Andre, but in the same milieu of concrete poetry in New York in the 60s. And then he gets involved with building these tremendous pavilions with the mirrors and the strange perception of bodies across these structures. But in the beginning, I think it was his text pieces and Larry's text pieces that got them collected into this group of conceptual art.
So at SMU, are you actually teaching art history or teaching studio, or do you try not to make that distinction?
Well, we have a department of art history, and we have a division of studio art. I'm officially in the division of studio art, but because I have a an advanced degree in art history. I have good relations with my colleagues there, which is not always the case in other universities. Yeah. And I'm teaching studio courses at all levels, and I do tend to teach the more discursive courses that are seminars in critical issues in contemporary art. I'm also very interested and been teaching about the history and theory of creative computation, that is, work that involves computers or those kinds of information systems that has been really developing alongside the visual art that we're most used to seeing in museums and galleries for decades now, if not through the last century.
So in your role as an art historian, you know, I wonder about the role of art history anymore. I mean, everybody's wondering it, if it has a role in people thinking about art. Do you find with yourself you have a kind of built-in resistance to the establishment, obviously, as an artist? So is it difficult to do history as an artist? I suppose that's the question. Which you do, I have to say, very well. I mean, you've a body of material here with your essays and your, especially the Cambridge collected essays, that provide a window into both the British and the American conceptual movements that nobody else has done.
Yeah, I mean, I have to remember like Charles Harrison, who was a big part of Art and Language and began as the editor of Art Language Journal, and that quickly was dissolved into a more collective relationship with the group. He is somebody who also studied art history and wrote art history and curated. I mean, he did the British version of the When Attitudes Become Form show that Harold Zeman inaugurated in Bern. And he had this interesting position. And I think to some extent, I understand it and feel sympathetic towards it. I think it's important to know about historical issues in art. And I think that to explain where we are now, we have to dig back into the past, or at least the recent past. I've been involved in writing art history around, first, the issues that I've been personally engaged with as an artist, conceptual art, but also I've done a lot of work on Ad Reinhardt. I've published a monograph on him. And there, I'm kind of looking for different models that have emerged through history of artists who have a similar relationship to what you would call the establishment, or a similar critical relationship to what it meant to be an artist, to the identity of the artistic role. And then, as well, there was a period where I wrote a lot of art criticism, particularly for Art Forum, and I had a lot of latitude there. And in some of the longer articles, the feature articles, I started to experiment with art criticism in a literary mode, adopting different voices of historical styles and presenting work like that. And that, I thought, also was a way to distance myself from conventional art critical writing, but also to engage in a different kind of criticism.
Yeah, and also maintain, you know, your sensibility as an artist, I expect.
Well, yeah, you know, it's funny. It's difficult for me to imagine that a person who doesn't understand their own impulses to creativity, or doesn't have an imagination. Everybody has an imagination, and the fact that it's funneled into a particular specialization is really one of the issues that I've been addressing throughout my career, why that should be and how that can be transformed in some way.
Yeah. So I know you have a job there in Dallas, but you know, you coined a slogan, you know, the artist out of work, and I wonder if you could talk about that, because it really resonates.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, this emerged during a period, I guess it was in the early 70s, people from Art and Language in the UK, Michael Baldwin, Terry Atkinson, Philip Pilkington, came over to New York, and we had some discussions in advance of mounting an exhibition at the then John Weber Gallery, a group exhibition. And we sort of went around the room and asked, where do you think we are? Where do you think artists are? And I just said, I feel like an artist out of work. And what I meant was that the competencies that I had been schooled in undergrad and graduate school, the kinds of discussions I was reading in the art press, what I was seeing in the galleries, these just didn't seem to be the ones that I was using in my way forward to make art. We were reading philosophy, philosophy of language, philosophy of science. We were going through all sorts of materials that were not part of any kind of standard curriculum or syllabus for artists. In that way, I felt we were artists out of work, because we didn't match. We didn't map onto what the expectations of the art world were.
Yeah, interesting. That sort of ties into the next question I was going to ask you about the notion of the collective, especially in the early 70s that takes off. I mean, it's not just the conceptualists, it's all kinds of people, especially in New York, where artists weren't thinking that they were going to make a living on their art and they weren't going to become famous, and they sort of formed into groups or collaboratives of one kind or another, to some extent as a kind of reaction to the gallery system. And do you have thoughts about that? I mean, because it seems to be the standard now. I mean, you know, the notion of the collaborative and the collective now seems, as opposed to kind of the star artist, it seems to be the way artists who really want to practice art are going now. Basically, that art becomes sort of conversation and it becomes something public.
Yeah, that's a good point to raise. When I landed in Dallas, I started to become familiar with the artists here. Yeah. There were many young artists who came and formed groups. They gave themselves a catchy name and they did literally in a couple of years, dozens of exhibitions of their work. The kind of collaboration that we were talking about in art and language really is more of a collective. For most of the time, the work was proposed anonymously. I mean, there were periods where that changed, but the idea was really to form a kind of a stable group for conversation. And collectives, of course, have been part of the history of art, the modern art and contemporary art. Some of them are formed, you know, really motivated by precarity. How do you get people to notice what you're doing? Well, you collect a group of like-minded artists and you put on an exhibition. And we see this with Dada, Surrealism, Fluxus, on and on. So that's one way. It's not necessarily the case that the work of one artist in the group will impinge in a necessary way on the work of another. Mm-hmm. And it's also not the case that the work is created collectively. Yeah. For us, the model of production was more like what you would see in a publication enterprise, where somebody writes something, throws it on the table, editors have a go at it, it goes back and forth and back and forth. We just all happen to be both writers and editors at the same time. So the texts that emerged are really texts that have gone through the mill of this conversational process and this editing process. I think that there can be sort of like corporatist collaborations where, again, it's about making an impact on the market and all of that. Our group has sometimes been referred to as a sect or a cult back then in the 70s. I even referred to it a bit sarcastically as an art gang. And I think for us at the time, I recall, the idea of quote-unquote making it in the art world was about the furthest thing from our mind. It was really remote from our consciousness. There must have been periods of many, many months when we really did not attend to what was going on in the art world in New York. We were aware of it, but we were not sort of going around glad-handing people at openings and so on and so forth. It was a very different scene there. It was rare to get anything by our group published in the mainstream press, and basically the fact that we had our own publication, our own means of distribution, really precluded that sort of move. So the collective was interesting in that regard.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. It had to have political implications, though, right? I'm thinking, you must have had, you know, Marxists in the group and anarchists in the group. I mean, in terms of your understanding of what you were doing.
I think the political aspect first has to do with really strident critique against possessive individualism, the whole idea of originality and the individual in art and society. The other political overtone emerged from many different sources, and I think perhaps the key idea was that artists should be managing their own production and distribution. And from that position, we get a lot of different kinds of projects emerging. But I have to say that one of the significant influences on that thinking, not just the panoply of historical left writers, but also feminism, really struck a chord with us in terms of understanding one's position in the world and then affecting some sort of transformation of that position.
So can you tell us then about the beginnings of the Fox, you know, your own publication there in New York? It's a publication, you mentioned the name, and people who know anything about art in that era, their eyes light up. You know, they remember it as something very positive. So
the Fox had a number of jobs to do. First, we decided that us in New York, that the kind of address that Art Language Journal and the indexing projects and other publications we were doing had to the larger group of artists was really not working. And we wanted to address some problems that really pointed to the way the art world was organized and how artists behaved in it, the quality of criticism, and so on and so forth. So it was also a result of a kind of a dissatisfaction with what the people in England wanted to do. Uh-huh. So we, in a sense, were self-determining our position in New York,
yeah,
because the positions were very different. The people in England were not centered in London. They were living in the Midlands, uh-huh, in pretty much rural villages. They didn't go near the flesh pot of London unless they had an exhibition at one of the galleries there that they were working with. But otherwise, and we in New York were really at the center of what was then the art market and the beginning of a node in the new global or international market of art, and certainly a media center for the United States and really Western Europe in terms of art. So we felt that we were in a very different situation and we had to address that situation directly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the Fox emerged.
Reading through Skull City, well, one thing I wanted to ask, but I wondered why the title, Skull City, Leaving Skull City, of course, you know, this is the second book in a row almost, Molly's Midnight, the Tempest essays, couldn't give me a good explanation of why she needed
right.
it. Yeah, so.
Well, I really agonized over the title for a long time. I saw a wonderful set of drawings and watercolors by André Masson called La Ville Crénienne, or Skull City, which was a kind of a diagrammatic representation of an urban conurbation in the form of a kind of a skull.
Yeah.
So very surrealist. But also, I felt that collecting these essays, which really ranged from the beginning of my career to, you know, almost really up to date at the time of the publication, they were a summation of some sort. And I do feel that, you know, no longer working with Art and Language, it's been quite a long time since I've worked with them, though I've maintained relationships with most of the members and have contributed to catalogs and have been part of museum surveys of the group and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I felt that there was some sort of transition that had gone on. And so looking back, Leaving Skull City is really about leaving a certain kind of intensity of conversation and intellectual activity replaced with something else, but really a very different kind of world that I find myself in.
Yeah. Well, it's very autobiographical, isn't it? Because it's a collection of things you've done over the years and, you know, get a sense of development, certainly.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to call it the greatest hits, but they are points that where I really tried to select pieces that exemplified the kind of work and the particular style.
Yeah, sure. There's a particularism about it that you get in when you do enter somebody's skull who's actually lived over a period of time. So there's a lot of experience loaded into this. So anyway, you know, as a librarian, you mentioned indexing. There's a sort of running theme, especially in the earlier essays, that has to do with maybe a way of approaching art as a practice, which is evident in you know, your first couple of essays, especially the one on Thomas Kuhn. It's on Kuhn's sociological study of communication patterns in scientific research. So it's about research. And then after that, you know, you talk about the Blurting Project, which is an indexing program. So this has got to be something that certainly should be of interest to any librarian. So I wonder if you could talk about those first two essays just a bit.
Yes, we read Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and the concept of the paradigm was interesting for us because it sort of made for us kind of a cultural space in between, the interstitial space between, you know, what went before modernism, late modernism, and what was yet to come, which we weren't so keen to identify as an alternative and say this is where we stake our flag.
Yeah.
It was much more dialogical. So during reading about Kuhn has got me involved in reading other things in philosophy of science, but then I came across the work of, I think it's Diana Price, who was writing about the invisible colleges and how big science has been organized and these information exchange networks that were really part of the life world of the scientists. And I thought that was interesting, and that related somehow to the relationship between the people in Art and Language in New York and the people of Art and Language in Great Britain. The indexing is really an attempt to solve a problem of what to do with all this material that's been written. How does a user, how does somebody outside of the group get access to it? And so we began to explore these ideas of this kind of information processing. This is where you didn't have a browser, you didn't have a laptop, but you did have a lot of writing coming up in library science on information retrieval, because the computerization of these kinds of operations was really happening apace in, well, actually in the military-industrial complex, basically. Yeah. And science was interested, too. So we really got involved with that. And Mel and I basically took a body of material that we had generated in New York over a period of months, and we started to index it, as you would index a manuscript, a regular publication. Mm-hmm. And then we created some kind of a simple logical operators that would link the entries in a way that we thought was sensible. And so the reader was invited to follow these pathways and also to make their own. So that's how indexing came. It's really an attempt to make a map of our conversational universe and encourage people to map their ideas about art and culture onto that. So this is sort of reciprocal operation, and this would be an entryway to engaging with art and language.
Interesting, especially, you know, with the role of a spectator here, and also, you know, this idea of the invisible college that you talk about, which would have to have a kind of archivist, right? So
yes, yeah. I know the invisible college always fascinated me. Yeah. I don't know, your listeners may be aware of it. You know, this is something that emerges in the 17th century in England. People like Boyle and Newton and Hartlib and others are corresponding with the so-called natural philosophers of their day, and eventually it becomes the Royal Society. And so this idea of correspondence, something that was free and outside of the realm of any kind of publishing, creates very interesting links. And it's also interesting to take up that model from science, because scientists live in a very different world in terms of the results of their research. And again, this was a way for us to kind of lever against the possessive individualism of the art world. Yeah. Anything that involves a sociality where ideas are exchanged and authorship becomes really dispersed was very interesting to us then, and it still is interesting to me now.
You know, it's right on the edge there of whatever, you know, the sciences and the arts are.
One of the things that we didn't talk about yet that's really a burning issue now is interdisciplinarity.
Yes, yeah.
And I mean, interdisciplinary research is very complicated, and mostly when artists have approached it, it kind of takes the form of perhaps a rather naive illustration of some ideas taken from other areas, or else a focus on the visually interesting aspects of a particular practice in science, you know, biology and so forth, these images. But there are other kinds of interdisciplinary engagements, which we were much more interested in, which were critical of the basic principles of the other disciplines we were talking with and talking to. And this is much harder to find. It goes by the very expensive name of ontological critique, okay? But it's where, let's say, an artist and a scientist get together, and actually the artist proposes something that does go to the basic principles of the work that the scientist is engaged with. That's an interesting relationship. But I think, unfortunately, in universities, you've got to fit something into an envelope called a course, and there has to be learning outcomes and so on and so forth. And so interdisciplinary studies tends to kind of throw people together who normally would need a lot of time to become familiar with each other's language and discipline before anything substantial should come up of it. I was involved just recently in an art and philosophy interdisciplinary seminar that ran over the course of a year, and we invited a lot of philosophers of art and artists to come and talk about this issue, and it really impressed on me how simply having long conversations with people over a period of time is really an important way to develop this. But this, of course, to relate to your question, the point is that art historians are increasingly exploring different areas. I mean, the visual cultural analysis movement was something where they're going beyond what we consider to be works of art and to visual culture in general. Uh-huh. And I think some of the most interesting work has come out of collaborations with art historians and other disciplines. For example, I think of the work that Peter Gallison and Lorraine Dalston have done, and Peter Gallison with Caroline Jones have done, in terms of the visual culture of science, uh-huh. architecture of science, how these things relate to very specific ideas in science, the nature of objectivity, how it's represented, and so forth. Yeah. So, you know, there's an area for art historians to continue to develop. I guess James Elkins is somebody who has been a pioneer in this, though I think that he has kind of dropped out of the picture. But this idea of looking at images that are not art and realizing that the world is mostly filled with images that are not art, you know, why shouldn't an art historian do that? They have the competency and the language to look at visual forms, so they should do that.
So next question, you know, we're talking about the collectives forming, especially in the 70s, and you have a chapter on the storefront and the storefront museum, and you have a question there, you know, how do you implement cultural participation outside of the museum, which still seems to me very relevant. And, you know, I wonder if you can talk about that, because I talk to public librarians who are often very much into this idea of the kind of storefront library, anyway, storefront arts center, driven by a desire to have a direct involvement with their own communities by basically making their libraries into community centers. You know, I know public librarians, for instance, who run free lunch programs for children. But this doesn't seem to be happening actually in the art world, whether with galleries or museums. So is this an area that we might be thinking about?
Well, the article you referred to was published in 1976. It was in a magazine that no longer exists, Studio International, which devoted an issue to what they called art and social practice, and which is, of course, now really a normal, conventional aspect of art practice. There are courses in art and social practice. You can get a master's degree, an MFA in it. We're familiar with relational aesthetics and all of these things. So it's one part of it is normal, which is to say, how do you engage with a public outside of the big institutions? Uh-huh. When I collaborated in writing this article, which is authored with three other people, we're looking at the idea of the decentralization of culture and a way to develop some sort of form outside of the museums and the gallery, but also where the culture of the particular place could be really nurtured. And there would be a place to display and discuss and consider and develop what cultural activity means outside of the art world. Yeah. And, of course, there are a lot of ways that this becomes codified with community art centers. I mean, in Dallas, I know at least one called Ash Studios that is working with this. And there are many, many more. I've met a lot of people in larger cities like Chicago where this is going on all the time. And as you say, public librarians also. But where they're adopting, you know, jobs that, you know, this kind of social work, which is, you know, unfortunately being filled in by them because
the state
is not interested in funding it.
Yeah.
Right. But it really was about decentralization. Yeah. And our focus at the time immediately generated that idea. And it was just a proposal. It never became a reality. And I think with the so-called alternative space movement, you got something where artists said, oh, yeah, we can get away from the gallery and museums, but that didn't last all that long, and it didn't remain all that alternative. But we had been doing research on federal funding of the arts, and in particular the way the NEA at the time was seeking to fund international blockbuster exhibitions. You know, the basic problem was these things are huge shows. For example, The Gold of Tutankhamun. Or you can imagine an exhibition of Impressionist paintings traveling from the Musée d'Orsay to the Metropolitan. The insurance premiums on a show like this are astronomical. So the government said, we will underwrite these because we believe that it is in the national interest to have cultural exchange. And so we were looking at this. We did some research on this. We published some articles in the Fox on this. And we thought there has to be a counterbalance. Right. And that's where the idea of the storefront as a cultural center, decentralized cultural center, emerged.
Yeah. The Rockefellers figure in this too, don't they? So.
Well, to the extent that Nelson Rockefeller was one of the key people early on to develop exchange programs between Museum of Modern Art and Latin America.
Yeah.
And then all of that. It wasn't simply the Rockefellers, but we identified the Museum of Modern Art was something. We even made a video about this. Part of it was filmed in the museum, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, rather. And we asked people if they knew about the Arts and Artifacts Indemnity Act, which is what it was called.
Yeah. That was a fascinating video, I have to say. I did see that.
You did see that? Oh, that's amazing. Because
it's not on YouTube, unfortunately. But
no, it isn't. I think you've got to go to the Getty Archives. You could request it. Yeah. They've digitized it, so you could actually download it. Yeah. But in any case, I think now, especially with all of the emphasis on the global work of art and triennials and documenta, we have this recurring problem of what happens to local cultures, what happens to what used to be called the problem of provincialism, which was something that I think Ian Byrne really pioneered in his writing, coming from Australia, really, really feeling the weight of American modernist painting as he grew up and worked as an artist in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Now I think, I don't know.
Yeah.
Occasionally the topic comes up in Texas too. But
yeah, the art fairs are no help, that's for sure.
We have all these satellites, this entire kind of, you know, shell hovering above us where you can go from one to the other. You'll see the same people.
Yeah, exactly. So
halfway around the world.
So you have a piece on your dealings with the Ad Reinhardt estate and developing your monograph on Ad Reinhardt, which I say is a remarkable publication. You published a sort of seminal biographical study of Reinhardt that has no illustrations in it.
Yes.
And I thought your essay about that was just fascinating, and from an intellectual property perspective, you know, in the arts.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I would say that this has been an ongoing struggle for fair use. In the spring of 2017, in the magazine Art Journal of College Art Association, I published a piece which takes another perspective, really talking about intellectual property in terms of the relative positions of power and status of the art historian and the estate of the artist. And because the College Art Association is a big proponent of fair use, we published many of the illustrations that I had originally intended for the book, but didn't get permission to publish. Now, as it turns out, because my disagreement with the estate at sometimes, you know, was pretty vitriolic, it really turned nasty on the other side. And there is an instance where even other art historians working who cite my work with approval were initially denied permission to reproduce illustrations as well. So this kind of censorship really annoyed me, as it should everybody. It's just unacceptable. But the CAA is really very interested in intellectual property. I've just recently joined the Committee on Intellectual Property. And our question now that we're posing is, where do we go now that the fair use is something that we're advocating? How does this become a reality rather than just something that people might want to dip their toe into, but others, like big publishers, don't want to risk a lawsuit because it is really case law that's determining the conventions of fair use.
Yeah.
So my work with Reinhardt was particularly important in learning, getting my knowledge up to speed about, what these things were and how far one could go. It meant that the book had to be totally rewritten, and the publication was eventually delayed 2 years because of that.
Yeah.
And, I think it was great that we published it. A lot of people said, wow, that's fantastic. It's really serious that it has no illustrations. What a brilliant idea. But,
Well, it would have been a nice illustration.
I can say, and if there are be art historians listening to this, they know how expensive it is, much time and energy is consumed by getting permissions and images for reproduction. Thousands of dollars.
Hundreds of thousands, sometimes, for say the Picasso estate, I've heard stories of hundreds of thousands.
You're dealing with that. Yeah. Forget it. And this is a real break on publication. Yeah. Publishers don't fund this. The authors are generally asked to fund this by academic presses. So initially I had really about 230 illustrations set up, and so much of the work was either unpublished stuff or hadn't been published since its original emergence. So to make a long story short, the Ad Reinhardt estate, which now has the Ad Reinhardt Foundation, developed a website, and they decided to put all of the graphic design, the editorial cartoons, yeah, the illustrations, and so forth by Reinhardt online. And lo and behold, they're all there for you to see. And I must say, this was a tremendous development because, yeah, on the one hand, it vindicated a lot of my research. I had indicated Reinhardt was working under various pseudonyms.
Yeah.
And also, it's providing material which I didn't even have access to when I had good relationships with Rita Reinhardt. So this is great, and I'm actually satisfied if my pressure motivated them to do this as a way of saying we have nothing to hide.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Yeah.
Of course, again, as an art historian and critic would realize, simply looking at something doesn't explain it. The work doesn't speak for itself,
yeah,
and that's why I wrote a monograph,
yeah,
on it. And
yeah,
and what I said was principally what really disturbed them and something that they wanted,
yeah,
to censor.
They must have had some idea that Reinhardt was a Marxist, yes. But
they did, but, you know,
yeah,
this gets couched in, you know, oh, he was a socialist,
yeah,
or
yeah,
he really,
yeah,
turned his back,
yeah,
on this. So I want to give a little plug as well for Jason Hill, whose,
yeah,
new book on the reporting by artists for PM Magazine.
Uh-huh.
This is great. This is one of the most recent, just published now, recent pieces of scholarship,
uh-huh,
that is taking advantage of aspects of Ad Reinhardt's work that were really not foregrounded until recently. You know, the fact is people were interested in his paintings. The estate wanted to capitalize on that, and that was the reputation that they were circulating. But this attitude has changed somewhat, and we're seeing more and more of Reinhardt's work, in particular the 2013 exhibition at Zwerner Gallery, which,
uh-huh,
now hands state, had his editorial cartoons, his famous interminable slideshow, and a really interesting selection of black paintings from,
mm-hmm,
private and museum collections.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first time that all of this had been exhibited on equal footing, each aspect of Reinhardt's practice. This is something I've been talking about really since the early 90s when I first started to publish work on Reinhardt. And so I'm quite gratified that,
mm-hmm,
that has changed. If I had any part in it, great. But I think this is what art historians really need to consider, that, you know, the work that they're doing is not a cry in the wilderness necessarily. And sometimes there are some changes that will result from the research that they're doing.
You end the book with an illustrated dialogue between an academic manager and an arts faculty member. You know, so in a way, art historians may be up against the publishing industry, but sometimes we're up against our own institutions, obviously. So I wondered about that essay. Is it a kind of a plea for a certain kind of activism that artists are actually very good at? You know, because there's a lack of understanding, you know, on the top down, and of course, money's tight these days.
Yeah, the title of the piece that you're referring to, The,
yeah,
Wind of the Interim Position, is a vaguely autobiographical summation of my role as the chair,
mm-hmm,
of a department where I was brought in from the outside as a quote-unquote change agent and having to face, you know, decades of habits and attitudes about art, and particularly when the dean was interested in what he thought was modernization and the faculty were interested in having somebody that would defend them against all of the administration of the university,
yeah,
so they could just carry on,
yeah,
with what they were doing. So you can imagine all of the conflicts that emerged. I did it in the form of a kind of a graphic novel because,
yeah,
I think that's a very interesting way,
yeah,
to present this.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you right now that all the dialogue is verbatim.
Oh, is it? That's so interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a relatively short piece, and I do want to continue it. And the title, The Wind of the Interim Position, well, the interim position is really, you know, that's where every middle manager finds themselves. Maybe everybody finds themselves,
yeah,
right? I mean,
yeah,
you know that Bob Dylan song, everybody's got to serve someone. So I thought, yeah, this is a condition of the age because the manager is one of the key stereotypical figures of our time. And I suppose the other is the entrepreneur. And then we have the artist or the creative. So I just wanted to kind of add some depth to that from the point of view of someone who has done academic administration and will never, ever do it again.
So you're still making art, yes? And I wondered what it's like to be an artist in the age of Donald Trump these days.
Well, yeah, I just mounted an exhibition where my aim was to really explore what could be done with satire and parody when we live in a world where satire and parody is in our face all the
it
time,
is, yeah.
right? And
Yeah.
I think that this brings into play a lot of other competencies and areas from graphic design and media that have been part of the art world for quite a long time. But I'm interested mainly now in taking these and putting them in the form of a book, which I've done, and I've recently published this collection of images called The Fourth Book, and also interested in figuring out a way to get these things distributed relatively simply, easily, cheaply, so that they could reach another audience. A lot of people have been to the show and they say, oh, this is so political. Yes, well, you know, there are many ways to define that term. I'm not arguing that the work is going to make change at all, but I think that what I've done was create various kinds of visual scenarios that, to me, represent the ways in which power is exerted, power really impinges on us. Yeah. So that's what I'm doing right now as an artist.
Is that available then, online, if you wanted to buy a copy of the publication itself?
I'm working on that.
Yeah, okay.
And so as soon as I get a chance to update my website, it will be available.
Okay, great.
Yes.
I'll link it then to our link to this recording then, people that want to
look
it up in the future.
Yeah.
Okay. I noticed you're working on a sort of dictionary of art and philosophy.
Well, yeah, it's a book that I would like to write that is basically a consideration of philosophy from the artist's point of view. Some of it is historical, that's going to begin either relatively mid-20th century forward. It talks about how artists have engaged with philosophy and how philosophy became a significant resource of expression for their work. Mm-hmm. And I envision it in a particular form, perhaps as a lexicon. You know, again, you know, it comes out, a lot of these ideas are scattered through my writing.
Yeah. So I'd like to thank you, Michael, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe today to talk about your book, Leaving Skull City, Selected Writings on Art, published by Les Presses Royales in 2016.
Thank you so much, Thomas. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, same here. Thanks.